Greetings, fellow language lovers. This is John Fotheringham, the host of the Foreign Language Mastery Podcast. In today's episode, I interview Jason West, the creator of English Out There. Here is the phone interview, originally recorded November 22nd, 2010.
How are you, sir?
I'm all right. How are you?
Well, we're getting a blanket of snow here today in Seattle.
But, all right.
First one of the season. Anyway, maybe we could start off. You can tell me a little bit more about Languages Out There and English Out There. Why did you create it, and what makes it special?
Okay, how did we start? Well, I started an English school with another guy in central London in 1992, where we just kind of did a really not very impressive one-week introduction to TEFL, and we were young, and we did it because we met on the course, but we both did it to go traveling and try and earn some money while we were traveling, and we ended up going nowhere except sort of about a mile and a half south of where we did the course. And we decided bizarrely to open an English school with the wealth of our knowledge, and hired a room off a Chinese bloke in Chinatown in central London, and just sort of created some flyers and got going. And in about 2 years, we had the whole building and were accredited by the British Council, and it was crazy days. You know, we worked hard, played hard. We were sort of leading the drinking in the school and doing the teaching and the admin. And so that was like our sort of 20s. And then just around about 1999, 2000, we kind of just parted ideologies in a way. So he bought me out, and then I had a bit of a break, and then wondered, what do I do now? And then figured I was pretty much unemployable, having worked for myself from the age of 25. And I thought, well, I'll start another English school, because that's what I know and I have contacts. And then when I started thinking about it, I thought, well, I could do what everyone else does, and I know how that works, and I could employ a DOS and blah, 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 blah. And I could just replicate what I had, you know, and do some other bits to make it a bit different. But I don't know why I chose the harder route, which is one of those strange things, you know. You just, for some reason, I decided to do it differently. and the two, well, a few of the main reasons why I decided to do it differently were that I'd grown increasingly embarrassed at the number of students turning up to my other school, you know, having a written placement test and then doing an interview and being placed in a class at their level, and being told, here, this is your course book, which they'd already paid for as part of their fees. And then, you know, seeing quite a few say, I've already used that book. And this still goes on, you know, because we, like all the other accredited schools in the UK, pegged each level to a set text. And the set texts that everyone kind of uses in vogue, you know, or think are the best ones, are generically designed to be sold in multiple markets. So a lot of people turn up and are given books that they're, you know, they spent a few £1,000 on a 3-4 week course, and they're using a book they've used for the last year in their evening classes. And I just thought that wasn't a terribly good product. And, you know, I empathized when people found it a bit galling.
But maybe the flip side of that is, on the student side, I think people often misequate finishing a chapter with learning, you know, with internalizing
something.
So they might have actually finished the book, but they didn't necessarily internalize any of it or much of it, so...
No, I agree completely, but you know, and but they, But then the it was just like the first impression was
right,
like,
no,
you know,
no, absolutely.
This is really not a good idea. You know, I've just spent all this money and look what I got. and then also there was this thing, you know, that and it's funny, I was talking to someone today about this who mentioned it without me talking about it. And the fact that they were in London and most ESL schools around the world, well, not most, because, you know, it's study abroad schools, let's say, where people travel to the US or the UK or Australia or whatever. When they go to an English-speaking country to study English, you know, they're put into multicultural classes. And they are taught some language, and they do most of their sort of focused practice on language in the classroom. And I just thought, well, come on, you know, this is a bit. Why can't we involve fluent and native speakers outside the classroom? Because in the classroom, they've come to the UK. Why are they spending all this time in the classroom,
right,
practicing with people with different first languages who are making different habitual mistakes,
right,
in terms of grammar and pronunciation? And so I thought, let's make it more contextually relevant to London, to London people, and, you know, and that was the basis of it. That was simply the reason I did it. And only after that did things start slotting into place in terms of, oh, hang on, there's something interesting going on here. And so I just, you know, found a building, got hold of a couple of mates who worked with me before, who were better teachers than me, and we put it together, and then we started doing it, and we tested it on some students, and then we launched, and we got some business in, and off we were running. But it took us a while to get the format right.
So what exactly is the format today?
Well, the format today is the same as it was back in probably early 2002. From then onwards, is that a student? Well, what we do in London, but you can do this anywhere. Is that for about 80 minutes, the students are taught some language, or they follow some exercises that get them using certain language and using it in different ways, manipulating the language, and then after 80 minutes, the whole series of sort of exercises and practice that they do, control practice in the classroom, is designed to get them to the point at which they feel comfortable using that language in a conversation, a short conversation, or a series of short conversations. And so we worked out that, you know, about 80 minutes was the optimal kind of time to get people to the point at which they felt comfortable. And then, you know, the next stage was that they in London anyway, they leave the classroom and they go out with the teacher, and we train everyone to, you know, say, excuse me, I'm learning English, can I ask you some questions? And very quickly that tells someone, you know, I don't want money. I'm not from your country. I'm trying to learn your language. I don't want a signature. I just want some help.
Right.
And that brings the sort of psychological barriers that people, you know, that human beings usually have. When a stranger approaches a human being, usually there's an initial suspicion, mm-hmm, and that puts up a barrier between the two people, and then it's a bit of a strange thing. But if the person who's approaching the English speaker approaches someone who's not moving, who's sitting down, who's chilling or just hanging out or waiting for someone, and quickly smiles and says, excuse me, I'm learning English, can I ask you some questions? Then 99 times out of 100, if the other person isn't busy, they say, yeah, all right. Boom. And then you're in to a conversation with a complete stranger where you can use the language that you've just studied. And then you also, you know, there's all kinds of stuff going on in there, and the sort of the wow factor, or the oh yeah moment is when the learner is using the language that they've just studied, or using other language that requires them to use that language, and there's always a negotiated meaning between, you know, an English speaker or and someone trying to communicate with them. So it's kind of like natural correction goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, instead of the learners talking to a teacher who they know, you know, and teachers are prone to correcting people often quite quickly sometimes, but also the student knows they're a teacher,
right,
and they know it's not a real situation, so to speak.
And teachers are also, I think, more used to listening to nodding
speakers. Yeah, they'll grade their language as well. They're, right, they're much better listeners, and they'll grade their language. So it's not in the psychologically for the learner talking to a teacher, a native speaker teacher, is not the same as talking to a complete stranger or someone you know is not a teacher.
Right.
And so when a learner uses the language and Joe Public goes, huh? What?
Exactly.
Sorry? Then they'll adjust their pronunciation and they'll, you know, adjust what they're saying, and they'll adjust it until there is understanding. And then,
if they don't start crying,
they don't because they don't start crying because they don't. It doesn't take them that long to get there. It might take a couple of goes if they don't get there first time, but because they've done the pre-study, you know, the revision of the language before, so they're kind of ready to go. And then there's that, you know, oh, that's what you mean. Okay, no, we say it like this, you know, and then they get into a conversation, but then they use the language from the lesson, but often, and it happens very frequently online using Skype and teaching or doing the practice that way, the conversation beautifully goes from what was in the lesson off on a tangent, and you get into a situation where they've forgotten. Both of them have kind of forgotten why they were there. They're just having a conversation. And that's when lots of really, really good language comes out.
Right.
And what you know, there are a couple of videos online of students doing the sort of the taught lessons and then out with strangers in London. And there's the stuff I've done with Jane online and Valdek. And there's a few other bits and bobs. But what you see generally is, probably without exception, is that from the start of the lesson, where the learners are looking and working with language and are not very confident with it often, to the end of the lesson, which could be, you know, 2.5-3 hours later, there's a huge difference in energy, in fluency, and in confidence. And when you do it with a group and you're out, you know, and you do the feedback, they go off and they work in pairs or individually and speak to people on the street. And when they come back to do the feedback with the teacher, sort of what went right, what went wrong, all that stuff, it is incredible the amount of energy that is generated by the group when they're recounting what they've just done.
Right.
And the effortless use of the target language.
It's amazing. And of course, this all stands in stark contrast to traditional language teaching.
So maybe
I could change gears a little bit and I could pick your brain on it. Why is it you think that the traditional approach works so poorly, or doesn't work at all, rather, for most people?
Is that your opinion, or are you?
This is an absolutely factual statement. No. I've been a learner and a teacher for, you know, about a decade now, and in Taiwan, in Japan, and in the U.S., I've just seen so many people try and fail. Granted, some people just aren't motivated, but for those that are motivated and do spend the time, most still emerge from, you know, many years of study unable to understand or use the language. And I'm just wondering, from your view, why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's the way they've been taught. It's the way they approach it, you know. I think most educational systems, state educational systems that teach people languages, teach it you know, teach them in a way that hasn't changed for decades. I was talking about this again today with someone who runs a big ESL book distribution service, and he's been going 37 years, and he said, you know, things haven't changed for 20, 25 years in terms of what methodology is applied in course books. And most educational systems and large schools and English schools around the world still use a methodology that is not sort of conducive to the way the brain processes, stores and recalls language. And I think that you know, the starkest example, you know, irrefutable sort of analogy or evidential sort of proof of that is what exists in Asia and China specifically, you know, is that like I did with Jane, you know, with our stuff, I met Jane, who, for people listening and haven't heard it, Jane's 27 and she's Chinese and she's lived in China all her life, but is now studying architecture in Strasbourg, and she speaks fluent Chinese, it's her native tongue, and fluent French, so she's learning in French and studying in French in Strasbourg, but she'd learned English for 16 years but couldn't speak, like you just said, and was still at, you know, very low level beginner sort of speaking, listening, but she could read and write English pretty well. And this is what, you know, she is a classical, typical example of an educated Chinese English learner who's been taught using, you know, the methodology and the course books and the theories of, you know, that haven't changed in decades. And there are millions of them in China and Korea and Japan, you know, it's they call it in China mute English. I don't know if you've heard of this phenomenon.
Yes.
And it's like the students find it amusing. They, you know, they go to mute English classes because they have non-native speaker teachers who teach them English without modeling the language, because they're not confident in using English themselves, so they don't get that. And all the exams are focused on reading and writing skills. Mm-hmm. So they go through high school and university not practicing the language. But also, I think it's more stark. It's starker in Asian cultures because they are more prone to the fear of losing face when they speak. Exactly. It's a sociocultural thing, and so the level of anxiety that they feel when they are translating in their head prior to speaking, mm-hmm, means that, you know, and I usually refer to a couple of psychologists, Yerkes Dodson, who came up with a theory and a chart in, I think, 1908, which is where you plot an X and a Y axis and it's performance versus arousal. And I usually change the word arousal for anxiety because that's what they meant. And this relates entirely to anything that a human being needs to perform. And speaking a second language is a kind of performance. Mm-hmm. And how it works is that, you know, if you look at the graph and you start in the left hand corner, a bit of nervous anxiety or arousal is good, so performance goes up. But if the level of arousal and anxiety continues rising, you'll get to a point at which performance drops away like a stone. And any actor who goes blank will tell you about this, mm-hmm, who forgets their lines. Any athlete professional athlete who gets overhyped up before a game will tell you that they don't play as well, or they can play pretty terribly because they're overstimulated, they're over-aroused, and they're over-anxious. And this is what Stevic, I think, referred to as lathophobic aphasia, which is when, you know, a language speaker is translating in their head and they know they're going to have to speak to someone who is not a teacher, who's a fluent or native speaker. And as they get closer to that point, their level of anxiety goes up, and then they get there, bang, and the words are gone. And that is something that I've experienced Japanese, Chinese students, you know, happening with them all the time. And I think it's also, you know, I think Stevic's lathophobic aphasia is the sort of extreme example of it, but I think it also is the same thing as Krashen's output filter, you know. Right.
Effective filter.
The effective filter, yeah, yeah. So, you know, when you need his lowering of the effective filter is basically lowering the anxiety level.
Right.
If you lower the level of anxiety, then you're more likely to be able to absorb information, acquire language, and speak. But I mean, I've had a long sort of discussion with Krashen about this, and we kind of agree on everything. But he still doesn't like the fact that in our stuff we use some focus on form. Right. And the reason I explained to him that we use the focus on form is not what everyone thinks we use it for, which is, you know, if someone sees, you know, say, well, Steve Krashen sees, when he saw our stuff, he goes, you know, you're still using focus on grammar is evil, you know, it confuses and is dangerous. And I said, well, hang on, you know, there are all these students who've been taught this way for so long.
Right.
And if you ask them to do something completely different,
yep,
and then speak, they're going to be floundering.
Right. They'll revolt.
Their brain will revolt,
right.
You know, but giving them a bit of focus on form, giving them some exercises that rehearse and revise language that they already know and that they find easy to read and write. And then set up and support them through a controlled but real speaking experience is a way to get their confidence levels up. And when their confidence levels go up, they become more motivated because they have small steps or small experiences of real communicative success with the language they've just studied.
Right.
And also they pick up a lot of new language as well. So what you get with an EOT course, the reason why it works really well is because it provides them with these little real experiences of success, which keep them motivated and build and boost their confidence. And everyone, you know, knows that it, when you're learning a language, if you don't feel you're making any progress, you become demotivated and you give up, don't you? That's what everyone does. You know, I mean, I know from people I know in the business that, you know, most audio lingual CDs click dust.
Right.
It's true. It is true. I know figures. I won't say who it was or where. So small experiences of real success, regular experiences of success, is what is the way to go. And the exercises are there as a psychological crutch. They support people. And they're not, you know, it's like I've said to some people, really, the language in the lessons is very much secondary to the process. The process is the most important thing.
What do you mean by that?
The process of getting to the point where you're comfortable having a conversation and being in control of it. Mm-hmm. You know when someone goes to speak a language and the fear is they're going to say something that they don't know what the other person's going to say, or they don't understand what comes back, and then they falter.
Right.
When even at low level someone uses our stuff, they have their questions ready, they've studied the language, they kind of know what's going to come back. They're only required to say a few things, and then they say bye-bye. So it's going to end. Mm-hmm. And you're just dipping your toes in and getting out at the lowest levels. And that's what Jane did that very cleverly. I mean, she's a clever student, and she understood what she needed to do, because what I did with her was, I said, okay, which lessons do you want to start with? And I knew that her reading and writing skills were sort of intermediate, or maybe even, round about there. But I knew her speaking was very poor. So, and I didn't say anything to her, but she said, I've got some beginner's lessons and elementary lessons with Chinese instructions, which I do have. I've got them translated into Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Russian, and Spanish. And so they're bilingual instructions that go right the way through the worksheet. So they tell you exactly what you have to do at any one time. They're very simple to follow. But she was clever, because she decided to do some beginner's lessons, because they were translated and because they were functional, low-level language that she wanted to perfect. Mm-hmm. And so what she did then was, by you doing those, she took herself to a level that the reading and writing was very, very easy. And using the language was very, very easy in terms of on the page with a pen. So her, and also the instructions being in Chinese meant that she didn't misunderstand what to do. So she knew exactly what to do. She understood the language and she knew she could use it on the page. Then all she had to do, the big bit that took a bit of bravery in the first couple of sessions, was to speak. And then when she spoke and it worked, she got the uplift of the confidence and the motivation to fire on to do it again and listen more, listen to herself, because she used the recordings on her iPod for listening again. And that way she got going.
Right.
And she worked, it worked really well. And that's I think I could honestly say that, and she said to me, when I played back to her what she was like at the beginning and what she was like after six lessons, she said, oh, you're a great teacher. And I said, no, I'm not. All I did was talk to you, but your brain did that. Mm-hmm. No one else. That was just your brain acquiring language the way it would normally, But we managed to turbocharge the experience.
Right. And gave her brain the right fuel to do what it did naturally.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm just looking at something. And when I was talking to Steve Crash and a few months ago, we were having a debate via email, and he sent me over something, and I hadn't seen it, but it's interesting. There's a figure, a diagram in something, in one of the things he wrote, and he, for a long time, you know about I+1. Mm-hmm. is the ideal sort of level at which to work with language.
Right, something just beyond your comprehension.
Yeah. And he's always been, strongly in favor of the quiet period. Mm-hmm. And not forcing speaking.
Right.
And that, that is quite a sort of strongly held thing. But he's changed slightly in the last sort of so many years. And I found this diagram that he has in some of his stuff, which is, I forget which paper it's from, because I haven't got it written on it, but I'll probably be able to find it. But basically, it says that.
Can you point it to me when you find it?
Yeah. Figure 3.1 illustrates the indirect but often considerable contribution output can make to language acquisition. And the diagram is very simple. It's just input, arrow going to the right, language acquisition, arrow going to the right, output, and then an arrow going underneath to conversation and an arrow going back to input from conversation. So a circle. And I started calling this with him of the virtuous circle, right? Because if you can get an I plus one conversation with a fluent or native speaker where the level of comprehension is high for the learner, and you know, you can sustain that at I plus one and repeat it, what you get is really effective fast track acquisition. And also, when you're dealing with learners that have had a lot of input, like Jane and other, you know, students who've studied for a long time in the conventional way and can read and write at a higher level but can't speak, if you deal with the psychological barriers and support people through the psychological barriers, the Krashen's output filter and, you know, or the effective filter and Stevic's lathophobic aphasia in extreme forms, and you reduce the anxiety levels, support them through it, and get them into conversations at I plus one with fluent and native speakers in a friendly environment, all the language that they've acquired, or, you know, that's gone in from their previous years of study, starts materializing as speech.
Right.
And that's what happened to Jane. And that's repeatable with any student with a similar, you know, problems. And there are plenty of them, as we know.
So what do you think language teachers can do who are perhaps stuck in more traditional schools? What are some ways do you think they can apply some of your advice despite being in less than ideal circumstances?
Well, the thing with EOT is that you can do it anywhere on any platform. It's amazingly flexible. And the reason it's amazingly flexible is, you know, like, pretty much all materials, most materials that exist for language learning we're always kind of, most of them are conceived from the basis of, where's this going to be used? And it's going to be used in a classroom. And so people were designing and have designed materials for what I call finite space, which is the four walls of a classroom, and for a teacher to be the fount of all knowledge. So we have a teacher at the front performing, guiding or teaching the students in those four walls. And so the learner's journey through the language that they're asked to interact with is always limited by the environment in which it's used, and it's pretty much an unreal situation. And everyone, increasingly, you know, in corporate training, in all kinds of training, in army training, even in sports training, no one these days who's serious about anyone acquiring any skill that they can repeat without thinking would ever ask anyone to do anything difficult or that required them to perform a skill without replicating the situation
right
as closely to a real situation as possible, would they? You know, no football coach in the States would give a whiteboard session to his defense and then ask them to do it in the Super Bowl without trying to replicate it on the training pitch. He just wouldn't do it. So all the materials Most of the materials that exist for language teaching and learning have been designed for the finite space. And then if you think about the finite space of a language classroom, you know, the four walls, you go in there every day if you're on a course, you know, there's for the brain, there's nothing to latch onto to distinguish one lot of language that you're presented from another.
Right.
Because it's the same place, the same four walls, the same teacher, the same people. The only thing that's different every day is the language you're using.
Right.
And that's not how the brain works.
Right. This, this reminds me of something I just read in a book called Brain Rules. Have you familiar with that?
And they, no, I don't.
It's a great book. But they talk about how I think there's about a 25% difference in recall if you learn something and then perform it in the same environment.
Yeah.
And I did a study where they had two groups of people had to memorize a list of random words. Mm. And they had one group who memorized them while floating in the water and one group memorized them standing on the beach.
Mm.
And then they reversed them. Mm. And when asked to recall the list, those that learned it on the beach could recall it 25% better if they repeated it on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And those that learned it in the water, same thing. But if they reversed them, there was a 25% decrease in their ability to recall.
But that's what that says is the brain connects things.
Right.
And that's what I'm talking about here is that, you know, the brain will connect language because language is linked to, you know, emotion quite strongly because that's how we convey our emotion in the larger sense is through what we say. And so when you're in a classroom and say you're on a 5 week, you know, or doing a 1 week course in 5 days, 3 hours a day in a classroom studying English, you know, a conventional teacher or conventional method taught by a conventional teacher would say, well, that's fantastic. We're in a classroom, nice, secure, safe environment, everyone concentrating, and there's no distractions, so we can all concentrate on the language. And I would say, all right, if I taught the same language using our way, every day I'd have the students doing the lesson in a different place that was relevant to the language, and I'd have them meeting different people and in different, you know, outside in different environments. But the environment every day would be completely different, and where they practice the language and the people they do it with would be completely different. So when they come to try and use the language with our way, instead of having just the same four walls and the same people as potential sort of cognitive markers or triggers to get back to the language in their brain, you know, that isn't very useful because it all kind of blends into one. With our way, they've built up, you know, a different story every day in their head that has different connections to that language and multiple connections. You know, for example, you know, in London we could teach someone some language and take them out, get them using it with people outside the British Museum. There might be a hot dog seller nearby. You can smell hot dogs. It's a hot sunny day. You meet someone really interesting who's got a really wonky eye, you know, or mad hair, or is a bit interesting or strange, or something funny happens, or you have a. But basically, you've got a three-dimensional, multi-sensory mind map that enables you, when you need to use that language again, you get back there a lot quicker than you would if you're trying to recall it from using it or practicing it in a classroom.
Right.
And then, you know, there's it's like Jane said, you know, once someone gets used to, you know, I mean, it's like she said in the feedback when we asked her, she said, speaking English became like a habit.
There it is.
And that's what, you know, that's the best comment you can get, is that it becomes a habit. So it becomes natural and instant to start using English rather than your first language.
Right.
And I think the question was at the start, you know, why doesn't it work? Why isn't it working in all these places? Is that, you know, where most people are still wedded to a way of teaching language that isn't brain friendly.
Mm. There's a good soundbite right there. there's the title of the interview.
Well, it isn't, is it?
No,
it isn't. And the reason that's happened is partly, I think, you know, an evolutionary one, because teaching and learning has come from a very purely academic background, hasn't it? And most teaching and learning and academic sort of information passing or, you know, furthering of knowledge has gone on in institutions where the classroom is the stage, is the be all and end all. So,
Yeah,
you know,
they forget that, you know, our early hominid ancestors probably spoke dozens of languages, which they learned out there. There was no classroom.
Exactly. And we've kind of, if you look at it that way, we've kind of regressed, haven't we, in terms of language teaching and learning, because it has become so much an academic thing. And the academic side of it has governed the way it's been taught and the materials that have been created.
Right. Well, we could say the same thing for every subject. I mean, not even just languages. There's been this massive shift from, you know, tacit knowledge to declarative knowledge. You know, testing what facts you've memorized instead of what you can actually do.
Absolutely.
You know, I think. You know, a lot of this, I think America can take credit for in a bad way. I mean, the apprentice system that used to be the standard in England and much of Europe, it worked. It was a great system. Mm. It has its shortfalls, but I think in a lot of ways we should and can go back to that. You know, in a combination with some of the progress we have made, but anyway. That's neither here nor there.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. But I think testing, there's some funny things come up, you know, and people say to me, you know, well, I love it that you get the odd, well, you know, your course, you know, what exams does it, you know, work with? And I say, well, none.
Right. Well, how do you benchmark? How do you know people are learning?
Yeah. Exactly. I say, well, you know, and I put this on a post somewhere, and I think it was on LinkedIn in my group. Someone said, you know, How do you know they're improving? I said, well, I just use my ears.
Right.
You know, yeah. I don't know what you do, but I just listen to them. You know,
right.
It's like, I record them, and then when I've got a recording from week one, and I've got a recording from week six, right, I can hear the difference.
Yep.
You know? It's like,
keep it simple, stupid.
I know, and it's like all this, you know, exam testing. It's like I say to people, you know, well, doing, you know, getting scores for English tests, you know, it's like, why not just attach an MP3 to your CV?
Right.
To prove you can speak.
There you go.
You know, that, why do you need to pay for all these tests if you just attach an MP3 of you, or even video of you talking to someone? You could do it on your phone, couldn't you?
Right. That's great.
It just makes a mockery of this whole thing about box ticking and filling out forms, and, you know, it's like there's so many things happening now in education that are almost, you know, hysterically funny. It's like, you know, there's so much going on that I think that institutions, large institutions and academia, that has controlled things for so long, you know, I mean, I think they're going to shoot themselves in the foot.
Oh, they already have. I mean, here in the U.S., our whole No Child Left Behind just disaster of a system. I mean, it's just getting worse and worse. And there's been this, you know, false concept that you can audit education like you can audit a bank.
But it's politicians wanting numbers so that they can quote numbers.
Right.
So it's the tail wagging the dog, basically.
Yep.
And modern life and politics and business is all about the stats. But everyone knows, you know, that stats can be massaged any way you like. So it means nothing.
Right. Lies, you know? Damn lies and statistics.
Well, yeah, I think that was Winston Churchill, wasn't it? Or was it Winston Churchill? I can't remember. Wasn't it
Mark Twain, I think?
But the point is, and where I was going, was that you know, I think we might be beginning to see it now. My mentioning of, you know, well, why do I want to do a test when I can just send you an MP3 or a video? You know, watch my YouTube video. Right. That's me speaking to someone fluently in English. But the point is that, you know, and like you mentioned apprenticeships, and I've seen references to this in some, what I consider slightly more enlightened circles of educationists, is that testing is going to have to change. People are just going to, people will be able to prove what they can do. You'll have evidence of your ability, and that could be using virtual worlds and all kinds of stuff, you know. But the days of scores and tests and memorization, hopefully, are in their sort of final hour.
Let's pray.
Yeah, because it just makes people. I mean, it's torture for me. I feel, you know, I come from an era where there was testing and we had tests and we did O levels and A levels, and I learned how to beat the system in some ways, because I was good at taking tests
instead of actually.
Yeah, no, my degree. Someone called my degree. I did a degree in history as the great degree robbery. You know, because I did nothing for a few years, and then I spent a week in the library and spotted questions, and then I got general texts to give me the gen on the question. Then I got the two main arguments in text, and I created composite answers, and I worked them out, bang, wrote composite answers, learnt the arguments, bang, went in, bashed out my degree. That was it. You know? And that's what we're kind of teaching people to do now, is just fill out the boxes.
Right.
And they're not thinking for themselves. They're not, and especially in you know, language teaching terms, it's you know, how many teachers, if there, you know, teachers this, how many of you have met students who have good scores, or, you know, can read and write well and write, you know, a decent essay or something like that, and then you meet them and speak to them and they can't speak?
Yep.
It's nonsense. It's ridiculous.
Well,
and it means is that the focus and the methodology of the focus of the methodology has been overlooked.
Well, the sad thing is we're now in a, you know, a sort of a space race of test scores, and at least here in the U.S., you know, we look at the scores of you know, East Asian students in math and sciences, and they mistake the scores for what they represent.
Yeah,
and so now we're instead of actually improving our education, we're now competing on test scores, and it's just perpetuating the problem. So I hope your prognostication is right, that we will soon, you know, probably through the demands of employers and businesses, you know, they're tired of as you said, having to retrain workers when they get there.
But that's so true. That's so true, you know, because you read stories all the time, or I do, about where you know, education's in lots of ways, and politicians openly say this, has become a sausage factory to churn out workers for business. And yet the people who are supposed to be the beneficiaries of this sausage factory are saying they've got great scores, but they can't do it, you know. They can't think for themselves,
right?
And so it's not working for business either. And if business is what you're meant to be training people for, or to be, you know, contributing to the, you know, the t- tax income of the country to UK PLC or USA PLC, then in lots of ways, like you said, the business is saying they're having to retrain people.
Right.
So it's not really working. It's not doing anyone any favors. All it is enabling a few people to quote some numbers.
And it's doing a great thing for the test prep and textbook industry. They're doing just fine.
Absolutely. Who are based in a model that is primarily academic.
Yep.
Especially, you know, in terms of language teaching and learning. It's I mean, I know some writers, ESL writers, who told me, you know, they've been asked to do projects or put forward proposals, and they put forward stuff that they know they've worked on that they think is innovative and works and stuff like that. And it goes in to publishers and it gets sent to their distributors, and those guys are salesmen, and salesmen are notorious for wanting to sell more of what sells.
Right.
And so the decisions about what goes or what happens are not being made, you know, on the basis of what's new and what works, or what's new and what is better, and let's sell that or find a way to encourage people to use it. It's more about, well, this isn't like what we're selling the most of.
Right.
So you're kind of, you know, stuck. And we've been stuck for a long time. But we're stuck because the industry is, you know, it's this thing about, you know, so often you get it, and it's a product of educational systems and the sort of slow evolution of educational systems. And this is a real point of friction now, is that the role of the teacher,
yeah,
is going to change, but it hasn't changed yet, and people are still producing content and materials and educational programs that have the teacher in a role that is traditional as the fount of knowledge,
right,
and, you know, all of that.
And then add to that now putting the responsibility of the test scores on the teacher.
Mm.
So they have this whole new push here in the U.S. of
so that
holding
they teach
teachers accountable. Yeah, teach the test, because they don't want to lose their job. So,
no.
And I can't blame them. You know, they're just...
No, they're just...
But,
exactly.
Right. No, so this revolution, I mean, it's not going to come from the system. It's not going to come from the incumbents.
No.
It's going to come from folks like you and others who are, you know, have the freedom and the, well, and the, you know, to be honest, the economic incentive to do what works.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's, I mean, you know, I think I'd go so far as to say that I think a lot of, you know, I'm a small man, I'm a small business owner. I've done this for 9 years. It's kind of like my life's work, but I've, you know, it's the product of a lot of people's work, and it's a lot of teaching and testing. You know, our materials, I conservatively estimate that before we even started thinking about getting them in shape for publication, we taught them for about 250,000 hours.
Wow.
With real, you know, teachers feeding back with real students on the streets of London. And so that's why they work, you know, because they've been taught to hell and fed back on. But, you know, it's the revolution is, yeah, this is like, if we use that phrase, like you said, it's not going to come from the establishment. It never, you know, which establishment has ever revolted,
right,
you know, no establishment
they have no
ever revolted on itself.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Absolutely. They don't have any incentive to. But it's difficult in ELT or ESL because for small guys like me who've got a great product that works, it's difficult to be noticed.
Yeah.
It's difficult to get a grip, to get some traction, because, you know, if I've had loads of people say to me, why don't you give it away?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's the free model, you know,
right.
There's free, all this, you know,
freemium, yeah,
freemium, and you know, free is the new whatever, and that is the thing, but when you look at ESL, there's so much free stuff.
Right.
And a lot of it is not very good.
Right.
Piecemeal, more of the same. Dull, dull, dull. No one's actually, you know, it's just like saturated with free stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you're almost likely to get more noticed by not being free. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Well, charging, but you know, charging for a premium product. You know, you justify the purchase with the. The product itself.
Exactly. And the business model I'm trying to work with, you know, and the beauty of digital is you can tweak and change and get feedback and alter things, is that, you know, I strongly believe that if people pay something for something, even a small amount, they value it more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's well proven, I think, psychologically. But also, you know, with our stuff, we have an affiliate program, and teachers can earn 25%. So if they use our one-to-one or on one-to-one stroke online materials and teach one-to-one, or they can use those in classrooms as well if they want, or teach in a virtual classroom. If they have students who want to use those materials themselves, or prior to the lesson or after the lesson, some of that. The teacher can sell them the student version and earn 25%. And if they have a class, they can sell everyone a book that's inexpensive. It costs about, you know, 40 cents per hour for a 60-hour course. And then they can use the materials, but the teachers can make money. And I think this is where it's kind of going, is teachers, especially language teachers, who've always been, you know, globe-trotting itinerant souls, you know, the nature of that is movement, and there's this huge sort of pool of discontent in ESL, you know, amongst the teachers at the coalface, that they get crap conditions, crap pay, you know, and you know, they are world-class moaners. I have to say, you know, I've employed hundreds of teachers, and they're world-class moaners, and lots of them are very good friends of mine.
Yeah.
And they won't mind me saying that.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, I've been there myself, and I think a lot of it comes from the fact that many ESL teachers have never worked in another field.
Yeah.
They tend to equate, you know, the absurdities of work, period, with specific things that, you know, happen to suck about English teaching. So at least that's my experience.
That's true. That's true. But they do, they are, you know, it's like, I had a meeting in London the other week with some teachers, and one of them was a newly qualified CELTA teacher who was at an accredited school in central London, a very well known one. And she was on £10 an hour, you know, which is, and getting 15 hours a week of classroom time. She was on an unsustainable wage in central London.
Right.
And this goes on all around the world, you know, and I think that teaching, you know, it's not only going to change in the way that teachers manage and organize their students' study or their learning process. It's going to change insofar as I think, you know, and we're seeing it already, there will be infinitely more freelance teachers doing it for themselves.
Right. Just need a connection and Skype and you're good to go.
Exactly. You know, and that's what I kind of think is, and I'm trying to help happen, you know, is like say, hey guys, you know, look, you can do it. You can do it on your own. It's like, it's only going to get better.
Right.
The connections and the places you're going to meet students and have support from other teachers. You know, teachers support themselves really, really well. They have great networks that they've built up online in the last 5-10 years, you know, and they share a lot of information and they support each other. and more of them are having, have got blogs, and then, you know, now everyone's got a Facebook profile pretty much, or a MySpace profile. And our business model is that, you know, I call it, I think I was quoted somewhere else as calling our content freed content, insofar as it's F-R-E-E from free with a D on the end from paid. So it's a small amount. It's a premium product that doesn't cost you the earth, you know, that's very affordable pretty much for everyone. And you know, anyone who values and wants to learn and wants to improve their English speaking skills, you know, they should be able to, if they can, you know, basically I can say to people, you can use our stuff. You don't need to have your own computer, but if you we do have a print book out and stuff, but you could do our, you could do EOT on under $1 an hour, you know, with real practice with fluent and native speakers on Skype or on Facebook.
Well, and compare that with the cost of Rosetta Stone, you know, which,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of people harp on it. I don't think it's a bad product, but for $800,
right, yeah.
If you get three levels, it's $800.
No, oh, I know.
All you're getting is just basically, you're getting some passive recognition of, you know, connecting words with pictures. For $800,
which doesn't work very well.
No,
flashcards. Yeah,
it's proven basically not flashcards on crack.
Yeah,
I mean that's what it is.
I know.
So for what you're,
I don't know if you've seen. A few weeks ago, when I did the thing with Jane and got the audio, and you know it is amazing. And
now is that available online for download or?
The audio is, yeah. Okay. I've got a podcast. Yeah. I mean,
I'll link to that on the.
Yeah, the podcast I did deliberately. What I did was, well, I put a message in on, I think it was English Club Online, EnglishClub.com. I went into a forum where people were talking about practicing online. And I just posted a message saying, first two people, I'll help you for free. But in exchange, you got to let me record everything and publish it.
Mm.
And the first two were Jane, who's Chinese, and Valdek, a 29-year-old Polish guy. And that was it. So I worked with those two guys using our stuff and just talking to me online. I showed them how to meet people on Facebook and create a little personal learning network of English speakers to practice with and how to approach them and get the most out of that and without pissing them off. That's what we did. And so our podcast is basically every second of every conversation is on there. The whole lot. Masses of data. And I did that and my contemporaneous thoughts and their feedback at the time and then later as well. This massive amount of data on there. So anyone doing a PhD is welcome to go there and pick it to bits, you know, and see they could follow every syllable of Jane's development in conversation with me.
Well, that's great.
And I did that just because I didn't want anyone to say, oh, that's not her, or, you know, that's not true, that's, you know.
Right, scripted or something, or.
Yeah, you know, oh, it's a trick, you know. It's not, it's all there. Is you can hear her at the beginning for the next 6 hours going to where she got to.
Well, I think that's quite revealing, though, about how few people do improve, because people are quite skeptical when they see somebody who actually has improved.
Oh, I know.
They always want to know what was the trick.
Certainly.
No,
there is no trick.
I listened a lot, and then I spoke, and I got better.
Yeah. And it was interesting, and I made some, you know, some connections with people, and you know, I got it's a human thing, you know. It's like there's research that I refer to, you know, there's a Dr. Patricia Kuhl, K-U-H-L, who's at, I think she's over your way in Seattle.
Is she wanting to work on the social implication of learning.
Social learning loans. And she had some 9-month-old babies wired up through a brain imaging machine and taught them Mandarin.
Right.
But they taught them Mandarin using every sort of recognized or commercially espoused methodology. Mm-hmm. And the only one that worked was pretty close to what EOT is, which is quite gratifying.
Congrats.
But basically, you know, like from her research, you can see that, you know, and this whole thing about the critical period is that, you know, brain plasticity for language is obviously, you know, much greater at a younger age. I've got two kids, my partner's Danish, and they understand Danish, and they're 2 and 4, you know. It's like, but you can see she refers at the end of one of her papers, she sort of hints at a sort of refuting the notion of the critical period,
right,
that it goes. And I think that the critical period is the point at which an adolescent or an adult becomes less able to acquire language is down to the fact that they're in an educational system that's teaching them to learn in a different way.
Right.
And also because they're becoming more self-aware. So they are like the extreme examples of Chinese English learners. They're less likely to mimic, to listen and mimic and repeat and make mistakes without feeling self-conscious.
Right.
So the educational barriers are increased because of the system they're in, and the, you know, developmental, the psychologically developed barriers are just, you know, what happened to people when they reach puberty and mature psychologically.
Right. They're internal barriers that.
Exactly. And then so what I think we've done is that if you find a way to break down the barriers that have been built up and get people through that. You know, that's kind of what Arcady, when I talked to him, you know, his system is about, you know, enabling people to forget their first language.
Right.
And just focus on the second language.
Right.
And develop their confidence in listening, repeating, making the sounds, you know. And I think that's, yeah, and that's what Patricia calls, she hints at the fact that, you know, the perception of adults being poor language learners, poor second language learners, is probably something that is not actually correct.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. But what I was going to say before is, when I'd finished with the stuff with Jane and the podcast and kind of sat back and chugged on my large stogie, which is a slang term for a cigar. I thought, you know, when you go on lots of different language companies, organizations, websites, and they all say it's great and sell your program and all that. I thought, well, first of all, I started Googling, you know, before and after audio, proof of language learning, proof of language accuracy. And I've Googled myself stupid, and I'm pretty sure that no one selling language programs today has published, or I don't know if they've even done it, but has any audio before and after evidence.
Right.
You try and find it.
No, I've looked. No, that's right.
It doesn't exist, does it? And then I thought, well, hold on. Let's see what their claims are. Let's see what they're claiming for. Okay, so I think, you know, we listen to Jane, and we can honestly say, if we can say she's gone up 3 levels, speaking and listening. Pretty impressive, 18 hours. let's see what everyone else says they can do three levels in, you know, based on the CEF, the Common European Framework. And I started with, you know, independent, small accredited schools. So I just did this, all of this stuff I found online. It's all published. It's all on their websites. No one could sue me because it's what they publish. It's out in the public domain. Mm-hmm. And the small independent school published Time to Improve Three Levels. Just a random example, a very typical one. 378 hours.
Wow.
Price per hour, $14.28. Any proof before and after audio or video? None. Big international chain of study abroad schools and in-country schools, you know, using communicative method, which everyone pretty much uses. Best published time to improve three levels, 480 hours. Price per hour, $10.13. Proof, none. Then I thought, okay, let's see what, you know, one of my, and I've had various involvement with them over the years, and they're held in very high esteem. I looked at the British Council, and I thought, okay, so I found British Council Hong Kong, and they've got over 100 centres around the world, and they charge a lot for their stuff, and they're very prestigious. And they're into, you know, CELTA training and all of that, and in-service training and personal development, teaching professional development. So their evening class in Hong Kong, 204 hours to go up three levels, they claim, $12.38 an hour, no proof, just a claim. And then I went to Wall Street Institute, and the interesting thing about Wall Street Institute, apart from the fact it's just been acquired by Pearson for about $90 million, is that they got 400 centres, but they don't, I don't know, well, when I looked a few months ago, they didn't publish any prices. And, you know, we also kind of know that they've had issues in the past with flogging what do you call it, payment plans or finance,
right,
for their courses. But I found a blog. This is funny, isn't it? This is an international chain of schools with 400 centers. And I the only price I could find online, and I'm willing to be corrected, was estimating three levels, increasing three levels, a cost in Bangkok in 2008 of $1,642.
Yep.
And did they have any proof? No.
Yep.
So then I got to Rosetta Stone, and I'm going through different styles now, you know. It's like, so I got to Rosetta Stone, you know, famous software that we just discussed, and now they've strapped on online social learning, which is an admirable, good thing to do. And best time to improve three levels, 165 hours. Price per hour, impressively, $3.20. Any proof? None. And then I got to what's probably the closest thing to what EOT does, which is fairly new as well, Live Mocha, in combination with Pearson's Active English course. And that's, you know, we all know Live Mocha is the biggest online social language learning network, 5 million users plus. Their claim that I found on the site, three levels, about 180 hours. Price per hour, a very, very impressive 72 cents per hour. Any proof? No. And then I put us in the bottom of the table at best published time to improve three levels, 18 hours. Price per hour, depending on what you bought, then it was 27 cents to 40 cents an hour. Any proof? Yes. Here's a URL. Go and listen. And I just think that's a really interesting thing. You know, I did it because I'd not seen any comparison of those three key things. time, price, and proof.
Right.
And, you know, I really hope that, that what I'm doing and what you do by raising awareness of these kind of things, and what others like, you know, Arcady and there are lots of people, but we're all small fry, you know,
right,
trying to do our own thing and do the right thing and help people improve their English or language skills in a way that's, you know, affordable and effective. I just hope that, you know, we can gel a bit and not, I think, you know, one of the things that baffles me sometimes about ELT is the control that the system that we described and the methodology that plainly doesn't work has on most of the people who work in the system.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of absurd, isn't it, to have a lot of teachers teaching something that plainly doesn't work very well, but not adopting new methods.
Right. Well, from what I've seen, you know, in Taiwan and Japan, there are those that realize it doesn't work and they're trying to fix it. But most of them are just putting Band-Aids on, you know, the gaping flesh wound. They don't understand what the root cause of the problem is or how to fix it. That, I think, is a part of the issue here. I think for you and I, because we're somewhat outside of, you know, we've been in it and we've also are outside of it. So it's easier for us to see and then treat, you know, kind of the root illness here.
I suppose you're right. You know, there are people, they're in jobs, they're busy. They got to, like we said, they got to bang out, get the numbers, haven't they? You know, they've got to get the boxes ticked.
Right.
So it's a tough one. It's a very, very tough one.
Yep.
But you know,
well, again, it comes down to us. I mean, it's going to be it's going to be those of us who are, we have one foot in and one foot out. But perhaps we need we need to unite. We need a lobby or something. Yeah.
Well, I think we just need to. I mean, I've been encouraged recently, and I've had some very dark days where I think, oh my God, this is going nowhere. What am I doing? I sit there with, I know it works. I know it works incredibly well. I know it's very inexpensive. Why aren't people, you know, bashing my door down? You know, it's that kind of weird kind of, oh, why is this not kind of being universally accepted as something that is more effective than what exists? So it's that human change resistance, you know, despite something being better and cheaper offered. You know, it's like we have to kind of just think of ways in which we can help people to change, you know, and I think I'll tell you one thing that's thinking, I don't know if you've seen this thing that's going to launch on December the 8th at Skype, of creating a website called Skype in the Classroom.
Heard of it.
And you know, I had a chat with them and since I've been using Skype, you know, there's always been this thing about, you know, how do we know who else is using it kind of thing. Mm. So this could be, I said to them, I really hope you're going to fan the flames here, because it's in their interest to fan the flames, to get more people using Skype and showing how wonderful it is educationally.
Right.
But we kind of, you know, what we need to do, and what some people are doing is to help people make the change. We've got to not only tell them it's better, but we've got to involve them, and we've got to make it worth their while, you know, because at the moment, and it I've always thought, you know, it shouldn't be too difficult to make a poorly paid disgruntled TEFL teacher's life easier. It really shouldn't. but it has been for a long, long time. And you know, it's quite astonishing in the sense that, you know, I don't know what the figure is. What, there's 300 million? Is it 300 million Chinese English learners?
I think it's actually much more than that.
Is it?
I think it's 400 or maybe even 500. Yeah.
Right. And you know, they're all still being sold. Yeah, well, no, there's all those Chinese English learners, and the modus operandi of the English language teaching business, the global one, the ones where people with, you know, CELTAs and Trinity certs and other qualifications get employed in, is that we're still moving people around the world, and it's a supply and demand thing. So we're flying in teachers or English speakers into places where there are lots of people who want to learn English. And, you know, it's not a very efficient system, but it's only efficient for the people who do the flying in.
Right.
Basically.
Right. Well, and there's this false belief that by putting a native speaker in a classroom, somehow it's going to fix all the ills of the system. But what I found, having been one of those people who was flown in, you know, there's very little you can do when you're shackled by the method.
By the method, yeah, and by the system they use, yeah. But then also, there's what I think, what was it, Cambridge churn out their CELTA, they churn out 10,000 a year. Okay, so there's 10,000. I don't know what are the, you know, Trinity's nowhere near that, but there's only, you know, a few thousand native speaker or non-native, but you know, TEFL initiated qualified teachers going into the thing. I think I saw somewhere there's about 4 million TEFL teachers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 4 million versus 400 million in China. Right. And so basically there is enough work to go around. Don't worry, chaps.
Right.
Don't worry. The problem is in the system, is that currently you 4 million are working pretty much, you know, as slaves. Mm-hmm. your
human promise, reporters.
Yeah. You are a commodity.
Yeah.
That is scarce. And all these people here are will pay to talk to you. And because you don't have the organization investment funds, blah blah blah, to set up a business to ship you and others in, you know, it's an old model. It's a model that's going to break very soon, you know, because what we've seen is all these people going online to go onto social language exchange sites. And, you know, you started off with My Language Exchange and then blah, 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 blah. And why are they going there? Why are people going there? Because they know that, you know, like anyone since time began who's ever been asked how their French is, they say it's a bit rusty. Mm. And saying it's a bit rusty means is an acknowledgement that you need to practice it. So they're all going on there to practice, but that hasn't taken off. It hasn't really, in terms of how long it's been going and how many people want to learn a language. And it's my, I think it hasn't taken off because they don't know how to practice.
Right.
Because, you know, if I put my Facebook page up there on my screen, within a minute or two, my chat boxes start appearing. And that's one of my sons, obviously flattened himself.
Did you go check on him?
Yeah, no, he's all right, man. No, Yana's down there. She'll pick up the pieces. is that you know, this welter of noise, this chat comes up on my screen, and people saying the same things happen all the time. Hi, where are you? Where are you from? Are you married? What's the weather like? What's the time? And what and an interesting experiment. And if you talk to any teacher that's tried to teach online or has an online presence, is that everyone gets the same stuff. You probably get it as well. Do you?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, everyone gets people trying to open communication with them and get some practice, either in text chat mainly, and then, you know, sometimes with direct calls on Skype or wherever. If you don't play the game and you just give one word answers and you let them drive the bus, slowly it stops. It grinds to a halt. Because they've run out of things to say, because they haven't prepared. And if you then say, okay, if someone says, oh, you know, can I practice my English with you? And I've done this a few times just to experiment. It's not me being cruel. I was just, you know, I just wanted to see what happened. And then I explained to them afterwards what happened and why they didn't talk or it stopped. But if you let someone call you, they say, you know, are you a teacher? Can I practice? You're like, yeah, okay. You're like, bang. They come on Skype. And then you don't lead the conversation, but you let them lead the conversation. What happens most of the time is, they run out of things to say. But also, if they do that with someone who isn't a teacher, who just wants to help them and have a chat and thinks it's a good thing to do and a nice thing to do, if they go into a conversation and they ask the same questions of the person that the person's been asked many, many times by lots of different people, if they put themselves out there, you know, to talk to people to help them, and then if they do get into a conversation, the person, the English speaker, we're all busy, we all have stuff to do, doesn't know where it's going or how long they're going to be there, and then they don't want to offend the person. So then they start thinking of ways to get off the phone line. Right. And then, you know, and basically, there are so many inherent issues in trying to practice a language online, even if you do it in a more organized way. You know, I'm talking about that's kind of on Facebook with chat leading to a conversation on Skype. But if you do it on a social language network, you still got to hook up, arrange a time, decide what you're going to talk about, share the time out evenly, and the other person might not want to talk about what you want to talk about, or flip it. Blah, blah, blah. There are multiple points of negotiation. And when you introduce multiple points of negotiation and you don't carefully control time and time speaking or guiding or driving it, you're not going to get a great experience.
Right.
And you're not going to get an effective experience or an experience that is as good as it could be in terms of the learning experience. So you know, what you need is some structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's getting back to nicely coming back to my product. that's basically what EOT does.
Right.
Is provide structure to learning conversations. And it's funny when people first do it, you know, they go, oh, and then it becomes second nature. And I, you know, it's an interesting thing that's what I meant when I said before, you know, it's the process. It's a process psychologically and it's a process pedagogically.
Mm-hmm.
And when the two meet and you have a good experience, you know, it's like I say to, I have some stuff that everyone gets that I call it social media tools. You know, when someone meets someone online on Facebook or Skype or wherever, you know, and they send them a message in the text chat box saying, "Hi, I'm using this new course. It requires me to practice my English with fluent and native speakers. Will you help me? You know, I'll only talk to you for 4 minutes at a time
right.
with specific interesting questions, and then I will go."
Right. No, that's an amazingly powerful thing, I think. It shows the person that there's a set time limit and they have an out.
You know, yeah.
It's not going to be this open-ended,
no.
you know, four-hour conversation.
That goes nowhere. Right. Yeah. And the questions are going to be more interesting because they've studied something, they've prepared it, and, you know, like I pick up the intermediate course book here, the print book, you know, lesson level 4, which is intermediate, lesson 7, magazines and newspapers, discuss magazines and reading. And you get into the task at the end is, you know, what magazines have you read recently? How often do you read magazines? Where do you usually read magazines? And if once you've got 15 or 20 fluent or native English speakers on your Facebook group or on Skype who know that whenever you send them a text chat saying, "Hi, I've just done a lesson, can I practice with you?" they know it's going to be specific questions that are interesting for them as well, and you're going to bugger off after 5 minutes, they are automatically much more available.
Right.
Everyone knows when they've made friends with someone online and they've swapped their Skype details and then they get a text message, you know, going, "Hi." And everyone, I defy anyone to say they've never gone, "Ooh, I'll ignore that one."
Yep.
It's true, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And why do we ignore it? Because we think, where's it going? How long is it going to take?
Right. It's going to be
blah,
a chore.
Blah, blah. It's going to be a chore. If you flip it and make it not a chore with a finite, roughly finite time limit, in and out, interesting, cheers, bye, bang, next. And that's where the repetition comes in. Because if you've got 15 or 20 English speakers in your network on Facebook, and you do an EOT lesson, you prepared, you go in, you go, bang, 3 or 4 questions. First one, "All right, thanks, bye," record it. And whenever you go online, if you've got everyone in different time zones around the world, you've got a few people in the US, some in the UK, some in Australia, some in India, whatever, you know, wherever they are, there are English speakers all around the world. You're going to have 3 or 4 people online usually.
Mm-hmm.
And you send them a little message. And if they know that it's only going to take a few minutes, whenever you want to have a focused, real practice conversation, it's there for free.
So one could probably say that this is narrow speaking in a way, meaning
yeah.
it's sort of the output version of narrow listening, where you have you know, a set of questions that you're asking a number of different people, so you're going to hear a lot of the same vocabulary repeated, you know, but with enough variety that it keeps it interesting.
And different accents.
Absolutely.
And you'll get different vocab. And when someone's got a bit more time, you'll go into a really useful free conversation where you'll forget that you're actually, you know, in a learning situation. And that's where we get the I plus one going on
right.
in a sustained conversation.
Right. That's great. It's a wonderful thing.
It's cool. It's great when it, you know, when you get the results, you know, it's nice to see and hear people improving quickly.
Well, it's the missing piece. I mean, we have these wonderful technological solutions that people thought would be a panacea, you know, for all the woes of learning. But what they didn't realize is that, you know, left to people's own devices, they'll just repeat the old ways using new technologies.
Oh, they will.
I think it was Jeff McQuillan, the creator of ESL Pod, said, you know, a fool with a tool is still a fool. So I think what you've done is help turn a few of us fools, help us use our tools a little better. So that's it's a great service. Maybe to wrap up, do you have any future plans to maybe look at some other languages? You know, maybe having Japanese out there or Japanese.
Yeah,
out there.
No, I want to. I want to get English rocking, and we did some a few years ago. We did some survival Spanish. We got some survival Spanish, and we got some survival Greek. Would you believe? And we got some survival. We got some survival German, but not you know, nowhere near as much as we got for English. But yes, you know, other languages. Yes, I want to get onto that as soon as I can.
Well, if you get to Japanese or Chinese, let me know. I'd be happy to be involved.
Oh, great! Thanks. No, I appreciate that. And it is. You know, EOT has been kind of, I call it a kind of crowdsourced course in a way. You know, it's the result of lots of people working together. Cool.
Very cool. Well, Jason,
thank you so much. No. Thank you for interviewing me and you know, being interested. I appreciate it.
Well, it's hard not to be. This is I think we're at a very exciting intersection of, you know, technology, methodology, and necessity. I mean, absolutely,
and we just got to keep telling people and try and make it something that they can live off sustainably for the teachers, you know, especially. I mean, I'm about to try and put forward some packages and, you know, just to finish up, it's like online language teaching, the best way you can do it is one-to-one. But I think like what was the name of the guy from ESL Pod, you know, fools with tools are still fools,
right,
is that, you know, we're still trying to take the offline model and stick it online.
Right.
And we've kind of forgotten that distance learning has been around a long time and kind of works, and supported learning is an interesting concept. And so, you know, you can't scale one-to-one teaching. No one can. And most people can't afford one-to-one even online. Most in one-to-one teaching online, you know, people won't pay more than $12 an hour or something like that, you know, unless – you know, you've got a good reputation and it takes a long time to do that. But so it's not scalable. Mm-hmm. But if you do it slightly differently and the contact time with the fluent or native English speaker, the practice is done kind of like you're doing it our way. One teacher, and I came at this, one teacher could spend just 35 minutes a week of synchronous voice time with each student and have 39 students and work part-time and earn over $40,000 a year.
That'll work.
it would work. I've shown it to a few and they go, yeah, that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
And how many teachers who are online have, you know, to find 35 people, and then you can say, okay, you give them support over, like, I just used our course, 20 week, our courses are 20 weeks. So you say one lesson a week, one unit, and you give them so many minutes of text chat support, so many minutes of email support, cut it how you want, but and then so much of synchronous voice. And they do all the practice with their personal learning network, their PLN of native English speakers or fluent English speakers. So they have a teacher-guided course where they can get all the feedback they want asynchronously and some of it synchronously. They can send their teacher MP3s of them doing the practice so they can listen to them improving, comment, and do that. But for the end user, it works out. I reckon you could do it. You could charge someone, you know, the learners about $12 a week. And for under $250, they get a 20-week course with unlimited practice with native and fluent speakers and a teacher guiding them. Okay. And the teacher earns a good whack.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to try and break that kind of thing, you know, because it's all about thinking differently, changing the system, and that's kind of what I think we all know needs to happen if it's to take off online.
No, I think that addresses the teacher end of the spectrum and the learner end of the spectrum in one fell swoop. So that's a good solution.
Well, exactly. There's no degrading of the learner's experience. It's the same experience and the same quality of experience. But it's just using a teacher as, you know, their time more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And everyone who's taught online knows there's a bit of, you know, drudgery involved to having to be online at strange times and teaching one-to-one, or, you know, doing a lot of one-to-one internationally online is quite tough, even if you're being paid well for it, because there are people all over the world,
right?
Different time zones. So you end up being a bit of a, you know, a sleep deprived basket case. Yeah. Anyway,
if we were charging by the hour, I would owe you a great debt. So
no, don't worry. God, no. I've never charged by the hour.
Charged by the word. That's more a better way to make a living. Well, I hope thanks. To visit London again one of these days soon. So maybe we can grab a beer or something.
So I'm up there sometimes. You know, I'm up there every now and then. I got a summer school running there every year and stuff like that. So, if you're coming over this way, let me know, and we can try and hook up. Be cool.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. All right.
All right, Jason. Thank you very much.
Talk to you. Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
For a transcript of this show, go to languagemastery.com. And if you've enjoyed the show, please consider rating us in iTunes. See you next time.